podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. The first thing to say this week is hello, Angola. Now, it's an unusual way to start, but in the Angolan... this is absolutely true. In the Angolan Apple Sports Podcast chart, we were 17. Yes, we were, number 17. There's some big hitters trailing in our wake. Hello, Jake Humphrey, if you're listening. But number 17... I actually misread it at first. I thought it was a lady called Angela who'd decided to rank us, but it was Angola. So anyone listening out there, nice to have you with us. And we say hello to Angola, but we say goodbye, of course, and that's what's known as a segue, to Fergal O'Brien, who's retired this week, world qualifying underway very much at the World Championship. And Fergal was beaten by Mustafa Dorgum 10-8, so his professional career ends. It was always going to be his last event. He did something, I thought, very classy, typical Fergal. It was understated. At the end of the match, so they've shaken hands, his opponent has left. Fergal's just putting his cue in his case, gathering his things together. And as he walks off, he just very lightly just tapped the table. And I took that as a sign of his own appreciation for what snooker's done for him. You know, thank you and goodbye. It wasn't a big thing, but it was just a nice gesture that said, for all the years, thank you. And it's nice to see that gratitude. Not every player, let's be honest, has it. But Fergal does. He said a number of times he never regretted turning professional, never thought snooker owed him anything. Knew that he had to earn it, and he had a very good career, of course. It was actually just shy of 25 years to the day that he won the British Open. So Fergal walks into the sunset. We'll be hearing a lot more from him, though, coaching, commentary, and lots of other things as well. A good character to have around the sport still. This episode, we're going to be catching up with emails, but firstly, some news, of course, from the Tour Championship, the main news being Mark Williams won it, which was a fantastic achievement for him. After he made that clearance against Tom Ford in that decider, which was a remarkable break, sort of you felt the stars maybe were aligning for him. Obviously, he had to get past Judd Trump, Mark Allen and Ronnie O'Sullivan, the three players of the season. You've got players there who've won between them 13 tournaments this season. Mark Williams, irrepressible, the word almost seemed meant for him, really. Just doesn't sort of stop being Mark Williams in a way. He's got that unique character. And yeah, from 5-3 down in the final, played superbly, won all 7 frames in the evening, and the ratings were fantastic on ITV. The peak audience just under 900,000, which for a channel like ITV4 is brilliant. It's one of the biggest snooker audiences they've seen for a while. The peak was 83% up on last year, but the real key figure, the average audience across the whole tournament, so all 7 days, was up 58% on last year. So that's brilliant. I think there are a number of factors behind that. One, there were bigger names in it this year. That's just a fact. Two, the actual atmosphere in Manchester. You know, you tune in, it looked good. I think the crowds there made it something quite special. That venue was a success. And if you saw it on television, you thought, oh, this is important. This is serious. And the other thing is, there's no doubt the second table helped because, as I said last week, what it meant was if a match finished early, you could go to the second table. There were a couple of days where otherwise you'd have been left with about an hour's snooker. So it's just obvious that if there was more snooker to show, you'd get more of an audience. But it's good news, and it's a general sort of uptick in interest we've been seeing all season, which is great. But let's hear from people who've actually been. Alan in the Peak District. He says, we're on our way home from a brilliant night in Manchester watching Mark Williams win. A personal delight as having been to about 15 events over the past 5 years. We finally managed to see a Williams match. Just wanted to give a bit of quick feedback on the venue and fan experience. Okay, so this is from Alan. Plus points. Great central location, big city vibe with easy transport links. Good selection of food and drink options at the venue. Great view of the table, even from the cheap seats. Overall, felt like a big event. Okay, and minor gripes. The seats were packed in, not a very comfortable sitting experience. Entry and exit back to the foyer. Everyone was funneled through a narrow and dark corridor. Seemed a very strange setup for those of us sitting on the far side. As is often the case, if you stood in the square outside the building, you would have had no idea the event was on. Can't be that hard to put some marketing banners up. Merchandising still not great. I struggle to see there's much of a market for a Joe Perry fridge magnet. No offence intended. All in all, a really good experience. Hopefully a few things that can be improved for 2025, counting down the days to Sheffield. And Aidan has also been. He said, I hope this email finds you well. Congratulations to you and having the world's best yet smallest snooker podcast. It's a fantastic listen every week, so I hope you can keep it going for a long time yet. Well, thank you, Aidan. He says, I just wanted to email in about the World Mixed Doubles and Tour Championship as I travelled to Manchester for the Sunday of the Mixed Doubles and also the first day and a half of the Tour Championship. Before I get into my experience of the venue, on the subject of random meetings with snooker players, I had a near meeting with Neil Robertson in the coffee shop across the road from Manchester Central. I was in having a cup of tea and breakfast wrap when Neil walked in and he was looking at the sandwich choices on display. He must not have had the one he wanted as he went straight back out again after a few seconds. I was going to go up to him if he had gone as far as the counter to wish him luck with the day ahead and the upcoming World Championship qualifying, but alas, he never went to the counter, so I missed out. After I'd finished in the coffee shop, I would say that's a bit of colour before we get to the main stuff. It says, after I finished in the coffee shop, I went out to the square in front of the venue, and rather than queue up to go in straight away, I decided to catch some sunshine, which had come out at this point. And as I've seen about 2 days sunshine in Ireland in the last 6 months, so I decided a little bit of extra vitamin C would be welcome. As I was doing so, I spotted your good self walking into the venue on the other side of the square. I was going to shout goodbye-bye to you, but by the time I'd seen you, I decided you were too far away to hear me, and I'd only look very foolish to the few other people hanging around the square as well. So I decided against saying anything on this occasion. Just on the experience as a whole, I thought the venue was absolutely fantastic. It's an absolute gem, which I hope World Snooker Tour will continue to visit for a long time into the future. The atmosphere was tremendous. Letting everyone come into the queue zone, even if they didn't have a ticket for the arena, was a fantastic idea, and maybe one that other venues could take on board. I can safely say now it's the second best venue I've ever been to, behind the Crucible only. It's just ahead of the Waterfront Hall in Belfast for me, and far better than Alexandra Palace as an overall match day experience. On the mixed doubles, I know the reaction to it has been very mixed, no pun intended, but I enjoyed it overall, even if it was a struggle for the players, especially early in the day. I checked Twitter, stroke X, before heading over, and then inevitably, of course, the women players were getting all the blame for the quality of snooker being less than what we're used to seeing. In my view, this was extremely unfair, given the limited opportunity they get on a stage like this every year. And as you said in your last podcast, the men's players struggled equally as badly for the majority of the tournament, barring an odd high break in some cases. Yes, it wasn't a great watch at times, but to blame it on the women was completely unfair to me. It just shows how players are not used to playing doubles anymore, as they disappeared off the calendar completely in recent years. Perhaps a solution to this is to have more than one doubles event every year, whether it be a series of 3 to 4 doubles events, like the Players Series, Home Nations Series, etc., to get players more used to playing this format to make it a better watch, or bringing back something like the World Cup as another doubles tournament alongside the World Mixed Doubles. I'm not sure, but either way, I feel it needs to be played more for it to be better. I'm not proposing that there's doubles at every regular event, like in tennis or anything like that, but I think it needs to be done more than once. Yes, I know you'll say, where in the calendar could we fit these in, and where would the money come from? But if there's a will from all sides, I'm certain it would get done, and someone like Johnston Paint may sponsor the series if they're already committed to doing it for one tournament. But fingers crossed, the World Mixed Doubles is not abandoned for next year, and eventually doubles is expanded as the women's players need more exposure in that environment and more invested in them and not less. Moving on to the Tour Championship, I know there's been some reaction to the change in format to 12 players. In my view, it's absolutely fine. In either method, having 12 didn't impact on my enjoyment of it whatsoever, but if others preferred 8, I understand that too. I do wonder if the calendar next year will be a very good thing or a bad thing for the Players' Series, with the Players' Championship and the Tour Championship back-to-back in March, and the World Grand Prix, while not confirmed yet, looks like it will have to be on in mid to late February, as they're the only slots available in the calendar. The World Grand Prix will be on after the Masters. That's the dates that it's in. So that'll be January. The seating for me was... my only slight criticisms of the venue is that on the Sunday, the arena was very warm with no air conditioning to cool it down, but by the Tuesday it had gone the other way, and on Tuesday afternoon it was so cold, by the end of the Mark Selby-Gary Wilson game, everyone was putting their jackets on and putting hands in their pockets. Hopefully they'll find a happy medium going forward. The seating for me was comfortable, though to give them credit for that as well. There was a slight annoyance to have no commentary on Table 2, and while I know you picked it up while Table 1 had finished, I'd have preferred it to be that commentary was available from the beginning. We'll leave it there, Aidan, because it's quite a long email, but thank you for the feedback. It sounds like you enjoyed your trip. It sounds like you enjoyed your trip, and I think that the feedback in general from Manchester, that certainly that I've heard, has been very good. Phil Spivey What a great tour. This is about the Tour Championship. What a great tournament this has been. It's fast becoming my second favourite behind the World Championship. The most informed players, playing long matches, what's not to love? I was initially concerned about the increase to 12 players and in some ways would still prefer an 8-player format. However, the entire first round, which would not have happened under the previous format, was outstanding. Every match was gripping, so maybe this format can work. It's unfortunate that not all matches can be shown during the two-table phase, but ITV have done a great job of switching to Table 2 once the players finished on Table 1, so it didn't feel like we were missing out too much. If a permanent home has now been found in Manchester, this could well be on the way to becoming a huge event in years to come. A fascinating final lies ahead of us. By the time this is read out, we'll know who's won, of course. Spoiler, it was Mark Williams. I've added that in myself. So here are a few of my highlights of the week. Zhangander's attempt at the reverse colours challenge. He just refused to play quickly and cleared it up like it was the last frame of a big final. Wonderful. Mark Williams' clearance against Tom Ford. Mark Williams' performance against Judd Trump. If you looked only at his match stats, pot success, breaks, etc., it was unremarkable. But to watch the actual match was to see one of the cleverest players in history at his most Williams-like. Some of his shots and his safety play were brilliant. And the first 9 frames against Allen were some of the best snooker seen this season by anybody. Your boxer's on a cliff line in the O'Sullivan-Wilson semi-final. It summed up perfectly the nature of an enthralling match that was even better than a 10-7 scoreline might suggest. Wilson, a dark horse for the Crucible. He's got the mindset and bottle. If he hits form, he's dangerous. There's not been a single match this week that hasn't gripped me one way or another. A fantastic tournament. Keep up the great work in both the podcast and the commentary box. Thank you, Phil. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's something about the long matches, isn't there? I mean, we kind of know this already, but they do, they make it a different feel, a different tournament, really. Alpha Bonzi. After what turned into a great week in Manchester with an all-time greatie Mark Williams lifted the trophy, my 3 quick questions are, number 1, a 48-year-old played a 49-year-old in the final. Cause for celebration in that it was 2 all-time greats with Ronnie versus Mark, or cause for concern in that there seems to be no youngsters on the horizon to dislodge the class of 92? Well, we'll deal with these one at a time. I kind of don't want to look at the negatives in that. It was a great match, 2 legends, everyone enjoyed it, viewing figures were great. To me, if you take negatives from it, I understand the point, by the way, but I'd rather just enjoy the match. We obsess about age so much. 48 is not actually old, really, not in snooker, because it's not a physical sport. And there are youngsters coming through. They tend not to be... The most talented youngsters, I think most people would agree, are now Chinese. There are British youngsters who are showing promise, and there are indeed European youngsters who are showing promise. How many of them will be exceptional rather than just good, we'll have to see. But I just enjoyed the match. It didn't occur to me that, you know, the players are too old. I don't see it that way. Number 2, how much of the success of the class of 92 should be put down to their wives who are holding things down at home, allowing Ronnie, Mark and John to concentrate on snooker? Well, I mean, it's a rather personal thing, that, isn't it? I mean, they're all... Well, Ronnie's actually not married, but, Mark and John have got quite big families. I think you saw what it meant to Mark's family. His wife, Joanne, has been by his side all these years, and the 3 sons came, and it clearly meant a lot to the whole family to have that moment. Number 3, whose idea was it to increase the field for the Tour Championship from 8 to 12... World Snooker ITV, the sponsor, and has it worked? Thanks, as always, and bring on the Crucible. Well, I kind of covered this last time. The idea, well, it was World Snooker who wanted to increase it, and it was part of a plan to make the event bigger in general, and also to not run the risk of having early nights if there's only one table. And obviously, towards the end, there was one table, and the Mark Williams-Mark Allen match looked like it might be 10-0 at one point. They were going to do an exhibition, but, you know, it ended up 10-5. Obviously, they have to get the broadcaster to sign off on that. The sponsor has less to do with the format. But that's essentially it, really. World Snooker decide the formats, but they work with broadcasters and other people, and they ask, you know, advice, and the players also can give their views. But ultimately, all decisions made are, of course, commercial. So anyway, thank you, Alpha, for that. Joe Richards, also on the Tour Championship. I've seen a lot of negative feedback on Twitter regarding the Tour Championship broadcasting. Now, I'm surprised by this because people on there are usually so upbeat and positive about things. So this must be an aberration that on this one subject they found the negatives. We continue. Joe says, one evening they didn't show the final session of Selby v Hawkins and they didn't show Williams v Ford. I could be wrong, but I'm sure 2 big matches weren't available to watch. Well, Mark Selby didn't play Barry Hawkins. Barry played Ali Carter, and Selby played Gary Wilson. And I did the end of that myself, so that was definitely shown. We'd showed at least 3 or 4 frames of that. Surely that's a bit of an oversight or a really poor decision. Well, like I say, we showed... I mean, I did the match. Selby didn't play Hawkins. He played Wilson. And we definitely did the end of it. So I'll leave out the rest of that paragraph because it didn't really apply. But anyway, I'm not sure what to make of the top 12 players being in the event. I think I like the idea, but it could improve. I wonder if the World Grand Prix could be top 32, players top 24... and Tour Championship 16. I just wonder if the top 12 is a bit of an odd one. It kind of works, but I wonder if not quite there. Snooker's always been about the top 16 with the Masters, etc. So I wonder if they're trying to make it different from the Masters, which I understand. I think the one-year ranking list separates it from the Masters anyway, so I feel the top 16 on the one-year list would naturally make it feel an individual event. Well, of course, that is the Players' Championship you're describing. I mean, the thing about the Masters is it started as 10 players for the first couple of years. I think it went up to 12... and then 16. So that increased its field. Now, if we'd have had Twitter 40 years ago, I'm sure we'd have spent 3 weeks people complaining, oh, you can't, you know, the Masters is 10 players, it's been ruined, it's gone up to 16. And it would be done in that voice, by the way. But the fact is, nobody now thinks 16 is wrong. The first World Championship, there were only 16 players at the Crucible. It went up to 24. It went up to 32. You know, the UK Championship, when it started, was non-ranking. It became ranking. So in all these events, changes were made, improvements were made, and they became major events or bigger events, you know, as a result. And the Tour Championship may well go the same way. This is me speaking, by the way. Joe hasn't finished yet. He said, big shout out to Gary Wilson. His progress has been phenomenal. Great to see him make the semi-finals of the Tour Championship. What a top bloke too. I wonder if he might have an outside chance to make the semis of the world again. Mark Allen looks primed to be world number one at the end of the season if he wins the Tour Championship, and Jill and Ronnie don't have a good World Championship. Well, of course, this was written before the end of the Tour. He didn't win it. He might actually be the first non-world champion, world number one. I could be wrong. Ding may also have been the first. Well, yes, he was. Ding was the first. Ding was world number one. That's a fact. And indeed, Judd Trump got there before becoming world champion. Anyway, we kind of got through that. Let's move on to our next correspondent. Yeah, this is a slight change of pace from Vincent. He says, I will again thank you for putting together the podcast and your excellent commentary. I was somewhat inspired by the listener a few weeks ago who equated composers to snooker players. With that in mind, here is my interpretation of snooker's top 8 players as car brands. Disclaimer, this is not as good as the snooker player composer's piece, but we'll have a crack at it nonetheless. I like the way he's already talking it down. Having sent it in, he's already saying it's not great, but, you know, I've sent it anyway. So here we go. These are snooker players as cars, courtesy of Vincent. Number one, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Ferrari. Quite simply the most prestigious marquee in motoring. Fast, easy on the eye, and they make the most desired cars on the planet. Not great for pottering to the shops. In snooker terms, not really suited to a flat 1-8 event at a leisure centre. But very much at home, pulling up to a 5-star hotel in Riyadh. These cars can rack up a ton in no time whatsoever. Number two, and these are snooker players as cars, Judd Trump, Lamborghini. An Italian stablemate of the Ferrari, but doesn't quite have the same prestige. Yet, could this change in the future? Fast, a little unpredictable at times, but if you can afford one, you definitely want one in your garage. Number three, Mark Allen, Audi. Okay, so these cars do have a history of speed and efficiency. Think the 80s Audi Quattro. However, they're best known these days for their pretty reliable family cars that get the job done with the minimal fuss. I don't think I'm being unreasonable in stating that Mark used to be a bit more flamboyant, but he's now just happy to get the win. Number four, Luca Brasil, Maserati. I suppose Maseratis are a bit like the younger sibling of the Ferrari and Lamborghini. Again, fast, furious and beautifully designed cars, but have been known to be a little questionable on the reliability side of things. There's four more. Number five, Mark Selby, Toyota. Ah, yes, Toyota, one of the most popular car brands in the world, not known for making the fastest or necessarily the most beautiful cars, but good grief, they are reliable, especially over long distances. If you're going on a very long drive, this is the car you pick. Those Italian car brands may look nice, but have been known to break down on a long run. Number six, Sean Murphy, Mercedes-Benz, known for being a luxury brand and their smooth, quick and pretty much bulletproof engines. Sean is a smooth and very watchable Qist, which has led to the comparison here. Number 7, and this is Snooker Plaza's cause, Ding Junhui, Tesla. Quite simply revolutionary. Tesla pretty much created the high-end desirable electric car market on their own. Similarly, Ding pretty much changed the face of snooker forever by creating a whole new world of opportunity for the sport in China. Goes without saying, Teslas are quick, efficient, and get the job done with the minimum of fuss. Very similar to Ding around the black spot area. And finally, number 8, Mark Williams, Alfa Romeo. This is very much an Italian car brand theme to the top 8, and this caps it off. Alfa Romeo have a very similar history to that of the Ferrari. They're fast and stunning cars, but they're a bit more accessible than a Ferrari. You can own one without shelling out an absolute fortune. I suppose they're a bit like the working man's Ferrari. Noted, they're more reliable than a Maserati. And you do actually, there are others here. Alex Higgins, Lotus, fast, noisy and nice to look at. That being said, they're known for being a bit on the unreliable side. We know the acronym for Lotus is lots of trouble, usually serious. I think that says it all. There's a few others. If you don't mind, I'll leave it there. But thank you for that. And we'll take any snooker players as other things. We'll accept them and we'll take them and we'll read them out, whether they're any good or not. And that was good, don't get me wrong. Now, Hiten has written with an interesting one here. He says, after being a snooker fan for over 30 years, I recently realised I don't actually know what some of the snooker tournament titles mean. I understand the common ones like World Championship, UK Masters, Championship, UK Championship. However, other tournaments such as the World Open, I don't know what this tournament means. What does Open mean, and how does it differ from the World Championship? Can you explain the meaning of these tournaments, please? And maybe explain how they're unique from other tournaments. Okay, well, there's a list of names here. So, Wuhan Open, British Open, English Open. Open just means open to everyone on tour. So, the 128 players on tour, it's open to all of them. That's what it means. As distinct from a championship, which is... this is where it gets complicated, because championship quite often is actually a sort of limited field, like the tour championship, but the world championship isn't. The international championship isn't. Why it isn't the International Open, I don't know. But it may well be that the promoter of the International Championship thinks it sounds more prestigious to have the World Championship in the title. Masters, again, it's just another way of saying the same thing, really. It could be the European Open, but they decided to call it the European Masters. There's only so many names. We used to have the Mercantile Classic. Classic what, you know? Grand Prix. It seems odd to have a sort of Grand Prix in snooker because... we only have one, but anyway, the names, there's just a sort of variety of different names. They don't necessarily have any greater meaning than that, really, if that answers the question. But open will mean, the clue there is it is open to everyone on tour, I suppose. Christine, I'd be interested to hear if any listeners associate any particular foods with their Crucible TV watching snooker memories. I spent the 2006 final feeling incredibly ill with an upset stomach. People say that final between Graham Dott and Peter Ebdon was slow, but my memory was of it lasting a lifetime. I was pleased with the winner, though, as Graham showed so much fight to get over the line, and there's always something particularly memorable about a first-time winner. On review, I put my illness down to eating some out-of-date fig rolls on the Sunday afternoon. I can't see a fig roll now without thinking of that match. Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, the 2006 final, I remember in the press room, someone brought in a chocolate cake. And, you know, it was people helped themselves. There was one slice left. And Clive Everton was on the final session, which finished about 1 in the morning. And he'd been in there all night, basically. And he came out, and the last piece was his. He scooped it up. It's a strange thing to remember about Graham Dott's career highlight, but for some reason that sticks in my mind. Joseph writes, last week Paul Moyes wrote in about the debatable camera work often displayed during a snooker match and wondered was he alone in his view, which you agreed you partly related to. Paul's take I thought was very much on the ball. I like when crowd views are taken in and seeing the players' reactions as they sweat in the pit is essential. But what makes me weep and gnash my teeth is the obsession on almost every shot of every match, less so of the coverage in China, the obsession with a view of the object ball being potted to the exclusion of what the cue ball is doing, and they hold that view as the object ball hits the back of the pocket while the cue ball, it seems, has retired or gone on holidays. They also do this on safety shots, which makes no sense as the object ball is not being potted and almost all the drama is on the cue ball. What part of the cushion it's hitting, the middle, upper or lower part, and whether it's coming off it running or check side, thereby letting the viewer learn. There seems to be a rigid belief that the entertainment of the game consists in the object ball hitting the back of the net, and the cue ball is a replayed afterthought. Finally, and most tragically of all, long deep screw shots don't exist on camera anymore, for which a main table view is needed to witness the magic of the cue ball take a deep breath by stealing our breath and pulling itself back the way it came. What do the camera cue invariably do with the shot? They go to the eye level with the table view in front of the object ball, so we never get to see any more the cue ball's beautiful defiance of regular motion, a great loss of visual pleasure akin to the weightless feeling you feel as a child in the back seat of a car as you travel over a small dip in the road. Well, that took an unexpected turn, but thank you, Joseph. Yeah, I mean, as I say, the cue ball is the most important ball on the table. It's definitely helpful to see it. That's just a fact. I don't disagree with that. But at the same time, directing anything on television when you've got so many cameras, you're trying to tell a story. I said all this last time. You're trying to tell a story and build up the drama. And as with a lot of these things, you're never quite going to satisfy everybody, I suppose, how you do it. Now then, moving on. Stuart Clark. When we talk about players practicing at a club, I've always wondered about the quality of the conditions. Take Ronnie, he practices at a local club. Would he have his own table there? Would he have the cloths and the cushions regularly changed? Or would the club do that for him? Can't believe a top player would get much use out of playing on a club table. Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is yes. That players who play in clubs, they have their own tables. They're carefully maintained so that they, as much as possible, match tournament conditions, or certainly the cloths and the cushions are regularly changed so that, you know, they get proper practice. That's basically it. In fact, there was a great story. I was listening to Neil Robertson on the World Snooker Podcast, the world's biggest snooker podcast, as we know. He was brilliant on there, very, very funny. And he told a story about when he was young, his dad, seeing his promise, built an extension in the house and put a full-size table in. You know, the idea would be he'd go off to work and Neil could practice all day. But he also installed at the same time cable TV, which Neil had never seen. And suddenly he had all these channels, films and sport and all these things he wanted to watch. So basically that's what he'd do all day. He'd just watch the telly. And then when he saw his dad coming home, he'd sort of pretend he'd been on the table. I just thought the way he told the story was quite endearing. And as it turns out, you know, things worked out quite well for him despite all that. Brian McGovern, loving the podcast as ever, was listening to yourself and Neil Foles talking about slow play on the Oliver Lyons Louis Heathcote match. I have a question for you. When's the latest time a world qualifier's finished? As I write this, I've been told Anthony Hamilton's match finished at close to 1 a.m. This was against Alexander Ersenbacher. Also, how many players of the year have been warned about slow play? Well, Brian, I don't know the latest finish at the qualifiers. I mean, it'll be early hours, 2, 3 in the morning, I'm sure, but I don't have the official time for that. The thing about... Here's the thing. Players are not warned for slow play. The rule is time-wasting. So it's not about playing at a slow pace throughout. It's about taking too long over certain shots. There was an incident at the Crucible 3 years ago in the semi-final between Mark Selby and Stuart Bingham where the referee Ben Williams considered that Selby was just taking too long playing sort of basic safety shots. And he had a word with him. And I thought at the time he was probably right to do that. A bit more subtly done than some of the sort of warnings we've seen over the years. But that's the calculation for the referee. It's not about how long you take over the entirety of the match. It's about how long you're taking over certain shots that don't need, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of consideration. And in that scenario, referees are entitled to suggest to the players that they speed up. But it's not slow play so much as time wasting. The two are, you know, it's kind of the same thing, I know. But it's considering a player is wasting time looking at things too much and just not playing the shot when the shot is there, I suppose. Now, we're going to go back to the Tour Championship. Steve Hooley says, long-time listener, occasional correspondent. It was one of my emails that triggered the phenomenally successful section, Banal Meetings with Snooker Players. More on that later. So Steve is, is the Alexander Graham Bell of that feature. Anyway, he says, I noticed when Ronnie was playing Gary Wilson that the right-hand tip of his shirt collar, a rather lovely khaki-coloured shirt, was sticking up behind his bow tie. This is a minor nitpick, but it really bothered me. I thought, never mind, someone would tell him at the interval and all would be sorted. But no, into the arena he comes again with the offending collar still sticking up. There was no solution to the problem when they returned Friday evening either, so the whole match my irritation remained. On to the final on Sunday, to my horror there was again, same problem. I had to ask myself, had Ronnie changed clothes between matches? Mark Williams did play really well to get on top of Ronnie to win the match 10-5, and apart from the 40-minute purple patch from Ronnie at the end of the afternoon session, things didn't really click for him. I just hope he's made aware of the collar problem soon, as I don't want it to cost him his 8th world title. Back to banal meetings with snooker players. I did ask you last year for tickets to the world final as a thank you present. I think your reply on the podcast was, OK Steve, watch your postbox. Alas, nothing arrived. I don't really get sarcasm. However, I now have the solution. It's obvious. Just sneak a small stool into the commentary box, and I can sneak in when you're on commentary duty. I promise to be as quiet as a mouse and not chip in. Well, small stool, we're back to the sort of table with Bill Werbeneck, aren't we? I mean, which is, again, you know, people have tried to cover that up, but it's still there in the background. But thank you for your service, whatever that means. Now, Rob O'Connor, inevitably this time of year brings up the old leaving the Crucible chatter. Yourself and the other correspondents did a great job of capturing how brilliant and historic a venue it is, and I particularly like your point that all of the memories we all cherish have little or nothing to do with money. If we do a little thought experiment, and imagine it were to go to a new venue with 1,000 more seats. The 48 sessions could take advantage of selling these seats for maybe £45 to £50 each on average. The end result is an increase in revenue of £2 million, though this assumes that you would fill all of these seats on the proverbial wet Tuesday morning in Stoke or maybe Riyadh or Beijing. My question is, where does such a sum sit in the grand scheme of things when it comes to the finances of the World Championship, given what BBC, Eurosport and Kazoo are paying for coverage and sponsorship and the fact the venue comes free courtesy of the city, would this £2 million represent a huge overall win for World Snooker Tour? I've no idea what the broadcast and sponsorship rights cost, but intuitively it does seem to be a gap that could be bridged. I believe a study has shown the value to Sheffield of having the tournament held there is something in the region of £5 million a year, so one would think some sort of deal could be done. Based on that admittedly poorly thought out argument, the most likely reason for the tournament leaving wouldn't be to get more people in the door for each session, but more than a significantly bigger sum is offered by another country to poach the most prestigious tournament. Failing that, I'm sure that we millions of snooker fans can put together an annual GoFundMe campaign to raise the £2 million to keep the tournament where it belongs. Enjoy your busy month on the mic. Well, thank you, Rob. I mean, the key thing, and you make the point there yourself, they get the Crucible for free. They don't pay to hire it. Now, most venues, obviously, you have to pay to hire. I understand Manchester wasn't exactly cheap. And, you know, if you wanted to get the Royal Albert Hall, you'd have to obviously pay a lot of money for it. So already they're kind of saving money by the fact that they don't pay a higher fee. It's true, obviously, bigger venues, you can sell more tickets. But I do think it's pie in the sky to think that on a Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock, for a sort of, no offence, a bog standard first round match, it's going to be full. At a venue like the Crucible, it will be, but a lot of venues, it wouldn't. But we'll see. You know, this is all coming to a head soon, and we'll see, I guess. Richard Colley, a tight change of pace here. Despite all the serious important snooker issues to talk about, I thought I'd start a feature which may or may not catch on that your listeners could help finish, namely snooker referees that look like other people. So this, I mean, people are talking about things on other podcasts, you know, that may in terms of the world be more important, but here in a slightly niche a feature, we've got snooker referees that look like other people. He says, I've only done a few to start us off. Hope the listeners get out of this. Okay, so Richard has got three referees here. Jan Verhaas, Ming the Merciless from Flash Gordon. Micah Kessler, England women's football manager, Serena Wiegmann. And my favourite, Hilda Moens, ex-Weakest Link host, Anne Robinson. As ever, thanks for all your hard work and contribution to the sport we love. Well, thank you for that, Richard. And, Richard, you may have started something there. They used to call, and you know, he's sadly no longer with us, but Alan Chamberlain, who was, of course, a very well-known referee, the tabloid press used to, his nickname was Officer Dibble. Officer Dibble from Top Cap, they reckon he looked like. And if you Google Officer Dibble and picture Alan Chamberlain, he's not the worst shout, actually, in his younger days. It's a bit of an obscure sort of reference now, but anyway, that's nothing new on this podcast. R.A. Bartle, I have a question regarding tour survival. As I understand it, the two ways of remaining on tour are either staying within the top 64 on the two-year rankings or being ranked in the top four on the one-year list of those outside the top 64. Those who qualify in the second way receive a new two-year card, whereas those who qualify for being in the 64 are only guaranteed to be on tour the following season. Well, that's all correct so far. They continue, in some very specific circumstances, this may create an incentive to drop out of the top 64. For instance, I read an article on the WPC website a few weeks back looking at players fighting for tour survival, and it mentioned David Lilly, who at that time was ranked 64th. Had he stayed in that position or improved his ranking, he would get another year on tour. Since then, however, Lilly has slipped to 66th. But now, he's top of the one-year list for those outside the 64, and if things remain that way, he will receive a two-year card. In the same article, Oliver Lyons was recorded as being outside the 64, but at the top of the one-year list. Since then, his ranking has improved to 61. Consequently, by dropping some places in the two-year ranking, Lilly is most likely going to receive a two-year contract, whereas Lyons, by improving his place in the two-year rankings, will now only receive a one-year card, assuming things remain roughly as they are. I know this is not a major issue and only impacts a small number of players, but it does strike me as a little unfair. What are your thoughts? Thank you, R.A. Bartle. We don't know the actual name, but since you wrote that, actually Oliver Lyons has dropped out the 64. He was beaten 10-7 by Louis Heathcote in the World Championship qualifiers. So if he's going to be playing on the World Snooker Tour next season, it will be through the one-year list. It's an interesting one, this. You're quite right. If you stay in the 64, you get another year on tour. If you drop out but come through on the one-year list, you get a two-year card. But crucially, you lose all your ranking points. So the player who's in the 64, they keep this season's points and add to them next season. So if you're 64th, you can add to your points and go up the list. If you get onto the one-year list, you're starting at zero. So suddenly you've got to try and make up a lot of points on the others. You're going to be getting worse draws and seeded lower in tournaments. So it's not necessarily an advantage. I think it depends where you are in your career. I think older players will be quite happy with a two-year card, but I think most people want to be as high in the rankings as they can, and you're kind of, it's a bit snakes and ladders, you're sort of sliding down and starting again, really. I hope Oliver Lyons does stay on. I don't kind of want to see these guys going to Q school, but obviously that is a fate that will afflict many. Jonathan Ford, I trust this finds you well. You mentioned a few podcasts ago a national newspaper was producing a dedicated preview of the upcoming World Championship. I was wondering, are you able to indicate which paper this will be? Also, musical montages from A Bygone Era, Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler from 1984, I think. Thank you for that, Jonathan. I think the national newspaper, I understand, is the Daily Star. I don't think it's any secret. It'll be out this week. So that's essentially it. Look out for that. I think, I'm pretty sure that's correct. 48 pages, I understand. Reese Powell from Sweden. Been enjoying your podcast. Keep up the great work. A couple of things I'd love to hear about if you get the chance. Ball weights. I've heard a few commentators comment on the reduced weight of modern snooker balls. Google hasn't yielded any info here other than apparently there's no official weight for a snooker ball. Also, when did the balls become lighter? I assume the TV tournaments used Aramith balls. Is this not the case? We'll start with that. I mean, yeah, over the years they've changed, the substance has changed basically. So they used to be ivory. It's a bit distasteful, but I mean, elephants used to be slaughtered for the billiard trade. Literally, you know, 11,000 elephants a year used to be killed to get the ivory. Not nice to say that, but that's what used to happen. But they were heavy, and then there were the crystallates and the supercrystallates, and now the balls are made out of a substance called phenolic resin. It's not the most exciting sort of topic, this, but that's what they're made out of. And they are lighter than years gone by. And what that means is, and with the thinner cloths as well, the balls do tend to spread more favourably. It can, you know, that helps break building. Helps that the players are better as well, but the conditions are better than they used to be. Second question from Reese. I'd like to be so bold as to propose a coordinate system for the refs when replacing a ball using camera footage. There's a lot of to me to you, back a bit, etc. Wouldn't it be much simpler if they agreed on a north, south, east, west system? I propose top cushion, bottom cushion, green side, yellow side. I'm sure they'd appreciate being told how to do their job. Well, thank you, Reese. I mean, this leads us into what happened, of course, in Manchester. There was a bit of a... Well, in the end, it wasn't actually a controversy because it didn't really affect as such the result. But there was a refereeing incident I'm stalling here while I'm trying to find the email. Oh, here we go. It's from Brendan Cowley. Thank you, Brendan. Do you know why the referee didn't review his decision in the match between Ronnie O'Sullivan and Gary Wilson when it wasn't clear if Gary had hit the red or not? Are the referees expected to review decisions if it looks like they didn't come to the correct decision? Surely it would be more beneficial for everyone if the referees reviewed their decision and ensured they came to the correct one, rather than having the unfortunate situation where Gary was arguably cost the frame because of an incorrect decision. I'd like to know your thoughts on this. And he just adds here, I'm very excited for the World Championship. After the fight he showed in his match against Mark Williams at the Tour Championship, I'm getting more and more convinced it's going to be Mark Allen's year, and I hope it will be. But no matter what, it'll be an amazing tournament. Bring it on. Yes, well, I'll tell you, before I get into this, excuse me, I'll tell you my story that afternoon, because I was commentating on that match. Paul Colley was the referee. Gary Wilson, he finished not great on the red, and he said to the referee, you know, make sure you're watching here because I might hit the pink. He played the shot. Now, from where I was sitting, I couldn't tell with the naked eye whether it was a foul or not. I made the point immediately that when the foul was called by Paul, that Paul Colley's on the spot right behind it, so he has a better view than anyone else. Gary didn't think it was a foul, and I wasn't sure. We had one replay which didn't really say one way or the other. But then I just happened to look at Ronnie O'Sullivan, and he was looking at me. And he had his arms out as if to say, is that a foul or not? He thinks we can see, you know, it's like the VAR room or something. We can see all the replay. Now, I'd only seen one at this point. But equally, it's not up to me to referee the match. I didn't know whether it was a foul or not, but I certainly wasn't going to start getting involved in telling the players and then the players getting on the back of the referee. There's a separate marker who sees the same footage. So the marker on the desk has access to that. The referee indicated he wasn't going to look at replays because it would take too long. And that's an issue we'll come to in a moment. But anyway, so that was that. They carried on with the frame. And then at the end of the frame, which Wilson lost, he walked out to go to the toilet, and he came up to the window of the commentary box and asked me the same thing. He said, was that a foul or not? Now, at this point, I still didn't know for sure. We've seen another replay which looked more like it actually wasn't a foul, but I couldn't say definitively. And again, I'm not going to be responsible as a commentator who should be an independent observer. I'm not going to be responsible for the mood the player's going to be in coming back. I didn't want to say to Gary, and I didn't know for sure at that point, but I didn't want to say to Gary, oh no, it wasn't a foul, and risk, you know, him getting angry or remonstrating with the referee. It's not up to the commentators to officiate the match. You know, that's what the officials are for. So I didn't say anything. In the meantime, we went to the ad break, and we had a replay that was much clearer. It actually involved zooming in, and you could see that it wasn't a foul, okay? It was an honest mistake. The issue really is not, you know, whether the referee made an honest mistake or not. I suppose it's why not use the technology. As has been pointed out already in the previous email, it can take a long time. It can sometimes take up to 2 minutes to replace the balls after a miss. So if you can take that much time doing that, why not take some time just to clarify on a very close call whether it was a foul or not? You can't do it for every match because not every match is televised, but if the facility is there, surely that helps the officials, because people at home are seeing the replays, so they know the score. So why not? Why not the same for the officials? I think it is something snooker's lagging behind in. We don't want it for every decision. It's only ever going to be a tight call like that. If the technology is available, which it is, then I don't see what the opposition is to using it. What I don't like, though, is, and again, this is mainly social media, people attacking Paul Collier, who is doing a good job and just made an honest mistake. You know, and listen, the players make mistakes, the commentators make mistakes, we all make mistakes, okay? And sometimes the referees do. But it was a tight call, he said what he thought he saw, it took four replays to establish he was wrong. And there was a suggestion, oh, what, you know, why don't the... I saw someone say, oh, the commentators and the pundits, you know, they're scared to criticise the referee. Complete nonsense. If criticisms have to be handed out, they will be, and they are. It's ironic people say that, the same people who, if they were in a room with the commentators and the pundits, wouldn't say a word to them. But there's a bit of safety doing it from remotely. The issue for me is not whether the call was right or wrong, it was why not actually use the facility of the technology to establish whether it was a foul or not. In the end, it didn't make much difference. There was another call later, a push shot, which, again, it kind of wasn't absolutely clear, but probably wasn't a foul. Anyway, that answers that, I hope. We have Nicholas here. He says, Mark Williams are split with Lee Walker, but now it seems they're reunited this week in Manchester. Any insight into that? Also, can you see the World Championship moving to another venue in England? On the second point, possibly. I think we've sort of talked about that a lot. Mark Williams didn't split with Lee Walker. He was with Steve Feeney from Sight Right. Lee was part of that setup. Mark parted ways with Sight Right, but he's still with Lee. So Lee Walker is still his coach. They haven't. There's been no split there. Alex Biggles. In a world of award-winning and world's biggest snooker podcasts, from what I can find, yours seems to be the original snooker podcast, and is simply the best. I devour all of yours and the others, and I'm desperate for as much snooker news, views, general chat as possible. But it's clear to me why yours is such a long-running success. Having always enjoyed snooker, watching the BBC coverage since I was a child, I've got more deeply into it recently, and your podcast has helped me on my way. My recently increased love of the game has been spurred on by my 7-year-old son showing an interest when I was watching some on telly earlier in the season. We now have a small 4x6 table at home. I've just become members of our local snooker club, and we're off to Cheltenham in September for our first live snooker match, afternoon semi-final of the British Open. Hopefully bump into you there. Fingers crossed the bar that runs across the front of the balcony seating that one of your listeners mentioned won't be too bad for us. My son and I have been loving the Tour Championship in Manchester this week. Looks like they've put on a cracking tournament. Mark Williams, you've just gone 7-5 up in the final, as I write. Playing a few games on our wee table at the same time, of course. Little chap won't have it any other way. I'm all for the merchandise your listener suggested on an episode I was enjoying between sessions this afternoon, by the way. An extra large hoodie, please. Keep up the good work with the original and best snooker podcast. Well, thank you, Alex. I don't know. Oh, you live in Bath. I wondered for a moment if you were in Angola, because as we've established, we're big there. But that's a lovely email, and it's good your son has got the bug. And so many, of course, future champions started on those small tables and progressed to great things. Let's take a banal meeting with a snooker player. This is from Joe Chapman. He says, in keeping with the seemingly traditional and now iconic banal snooker meeting section of the podcast, I think mine might fit well. I was in the line in Greg's in Basildon, and after wiping my eyes several times, I saw Stuart Bingham at the front of it. Seeing he was with his family, I didn't want to bother him, so I smiled, and in return, he slightly lifted his choice of pastry and smiled back. I hope this wasn't too long an email. Well, no, it wasn't. It was perfect, and that's exactly what we're looking for. No meaningful conversation's been had, and that's what we like. Now, this is a true story. I was in Chiswick, where Eurosport are based, recently, and I was just sat... Oh, I won't lie, I was in a pub, okay? But, I'm entitled to spend my time as I like. Anyway, walking past was Hugh Grant, the actor. He absolutely was Hugh Grant. You can sort of... I mean, obviously, it's Hugh Grant. I recognised him, but there was a certain charisma to him that told you he was a star of some kind. It was Hugh Grant. But I often, because there's a Hugh Grant that writes into this podcast, and I often say, not that one. Not 10 minutes later, did I get an email from the other Hugh Grant, the non-film star. Now, this is a rather controversial one. I'm actually not going to read it out, Hugh, because it's slightly disparaging about another podcast. Not this one, but another snooker podcast. I won't say which one. But they are apparently the world's biggest. But anyway, thank you. It did amuse me, but I don't really want to read it out. I thought it was quite funny. I got this email not 10 minutes after seeing the other Hugh Grant. Joseph has written in here. He says, I was listening to your Crucible Predictions podcast. I can't think Luca Brasil is going to shine at this tournament. His performance last year appeared to be very much devil-may-care. He was partying a lot into the early hours before some matches, which suggests he may well have been playing hungover sometimes. And the word hungover is a euphemism for being drunk to some degree. Just a slight legal note there. I don't think Luca Brasil was drunk at the World Championship. I actually think the stories about partying were overdone. I think, I'm not saying he wasn't out now and again, but I don't think it was every night, and I certainly do not believe he was drunk. But I'm just reading the email. Joseph says he also felt irreversibly behind in some important matches, or almost irreversibly behind. This approach, which, as we all have to go, all we have to go on with Brucell, aside from the fact he's never won a match at the Crucible prior, this approach was not a template for repeat performance. Add this to the additional pressure he will be feeling this year, and I'll be curious to see whether he can put in a single winning performance. I think it would be like Jimmy White having won the World Championship one year in the 80s or 90s, coming back the next year. The loss for Brucell may not be at this year's World Championship, but rather that he wasn't happier throughout the season, given he'd achieved his snooker dream. He made his paradise, yet has only looked adrift. What a shame. Well, I don't know about that. He's not had the best of seasons, but I think he's enjoyed himself in general. John Byrne asking about the Crucible Almanac, where he can get one from. I think I'm right in saying Chris Downer obviously produces it. He only produces so many, and I know it's been a bit of a stressful year for Chris, and he hasn't had as much time to devote to it as possible. I think I'm right in saying he hasn't actually, he's not going to print any more now. So I think for this year, you might be unlucky getting one, unless Chris can tell us differently. I think I'm right in saying that. Now, we're going to end, I think. What I will say is, well, there's a couple of things. Firstly, the World Snooker Tour app has been updated. We had an email a few weeks ago from someone complaining that it was still the old one. The new one has been launched. It's certainly better than the last one. That's not saying a lot. It was a low bar, to be honest. There are a few issues I've had with it in terms of getting it to load properly. That might just be me. I'm not saying that's everybody. So do let us know, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, your experience of using it. Some feedback would be nice. The other thing to say is check the podcast feed over the next few days. There might be some special episodes dropping. Then again, there might not be, of course, but there may be a couple of World Championship themed episodes dropping. We'll finish. We have a long-running series with Richard. He's sort of going round Europe playing snooker, and he says, following on from my last related email, where I played on wonderful tables in Budapest, I moved on south to Bucharest, where I found two venues to play. The first was via an address I found in the northeast of the city, where I took two buses to reach. It was a mostly residential area, and I walked up and down the stretch of road where I felt this place should be based on my information. There didn't seem to be a building here, though. I was puzzled. Then I peered over a wall that seemed to be roughly where it should be, and I was greeted with very large photos of Ronnie and one or two other top players on the side of a building behind this wall. I saw a door more like an open garage door. I slipped through a gap in the wall and walked inside. There was clutter everywhere, very much like a garage, but to the side it opened up, and there were five star tables and a couple of pairs of players. What emerged from our conversation was that it was a private members club, and there was a very rigid rule that only with a 12-month membership could you play. Not even for a mildly accomplished visitor from a distant land could this rule be bent. Fair enough, I admire the respect for the game and tables this rule was being adhered to so firmly. They told me they'd brought over the very top players for exhibitions, and similarly to Hungary, I saw a serious application by the players here and a seriousness in their approach to playing. This seemed to be getting more borne out by the makeup of fields in recent tournaments we've seen in the Q Tour Global Playoffs, European Championships and European Under 21 Championships. A large number of entrants in these were from Central Europe, and watching the trophy presentation when Liam Davis won the Under 21 title in Sarajevo, you could see the pride in the host there. Given I couldn't play at this venue, I later went to a place on the west side called the IDM Club, with a few snooker tables, pool tables and other sports and athletic facilities as well. This had a more familiar setup. Walk-in, paper hour, no membership required. Overall, I was very pleasantly enthused by my snooker experience in Romania, not by anything magical I did on the table, but by the enthusiasm of the people for our beloved parlour game. Going back to Liam Davis, I've been watching him closely for a couple of years now, at least, and in my humble view, I think he's got more of what it needs to break into the top 16 eventually than anyone else near his age group. He's very mature already, has no interest in anything outside of snooker, and has the full support of his family and parents. Also, consider his 10-9 defeat to Dwayne Jones in the final of the Q Tour Global Playoff to get a tour card, then to pick himself up off the floor within 24 hours to win every match in the Under-21s against tour card after all. Next time, potting balls in the Balkans. Well, thank you, Richard. Liam Davis, he was on the Talking Snooker podcast. I thought he was very charming on that. He's got quite a personality. He spoke well, spoke very honestly. He's out of the World Championship this year, but of course we'll be on tour next year. It'll be fascinating to follow his progress. If your email's not been read out, don't take it personally. I've just got to wrap up there, I'm afraid. But as I say, there may be other things to listen to from this podcast in the coming days. We're a week away now from the World Championship at the Crucible starting, but the qualifying continues, and I'm going to be at Judgment Day next week. The two Judgment Days, Tuesday and Wednesday. Looking forward to joining Rob Walker and Ken Doherty for that. You can watch it on the World Snooker Tour Facebook and YouTube channels, and indeed also on Discovery Plus. So that's it. SnookerScenePodcast@mail.com is the address to send any correspondence to. And we will be back, well, as I say, over the course of the next week. I'll definitely be doing an episode when the draw comes out on Thursday. So it'll be Thursday morning. As we build up, of course, to the World Championship, we're part of the Sports Social Network as well. And, I think that's it. So by the way, before I go, I should say someone listened to the podcast for the first time and said to me, "You have very clever listeners." And that's true, I think. The difference is that this is why I don't read tweets out on here, okay? If you're going to write an email, it might take you 20 minutes, it might take you half an hour. Your point is you've got to actually sit down and consider what you're writing and put some thought into it. That's not true of a lot of social media postings. It can take 20 seconds to just dash off a scathing critique of something. Whereas people who take the time to write emails and thoughtful comments are appreciated. So we have clever listeners, and that's come from quite a big hitter in the sport. So in the meantime, there's no meantime. That's it. Goodbye, bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.